Anything further from the company before? Well, let's be on the record. Anything further from the company before we proceed to the division? Thank you, Mr. Jeter.
Mr. Commissioner, if I may, Mr. Brent Coleman here. I was curious with respect to the spreadsheet that I presented. The commission asked, took a couple of copies, and so for administrative purposes, I was curious if it would be appropriate to introduce it as a demonstrative exhibit to for consistency with interpretation of the transcript and the discussion that I had with the witness.
Is there any objection to that?
No objection.
It'll be received.
So I have a clean copy for the court reporter. I'll go ahead and mark it as an exhibit.
And for the record, how are you marking it so that we'll be able to identify it in the transcript?
I have a sticker that was pre-printed as OCS Hearing Exhibit, and I'll just go ahead and mark that as 1. Hearing Exhibit 1.
Thank you. Mr. Jeter?
Thank you. The division would like to call Douglas Wheelwright.
Mr. Wheelwright, you have been previously sworn, I believe.
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
Mr. Wheelwright, I've asked you this yesterday, and I just want to re-ask it again today so we can properly introduce all of your direct and surrebuttal testimony to the record. Did you create and file direct and surrebuttal along with the attached exhibits to those in this docket?
Yes, I did.
And again, the answers with respect to everything in those we'll cover. If you were asked all of those questions today, would your answers be the same?
Yes, they would.
And do you have any corrections or edits you'd like to make to either of those?
No, I don't.
Thank you. The division would move at this time to enter the direct and surrebuttal testimony of Douglas Wheelwright along with the exhibits in their entirety, the portion that we didn't enter into the record yesterday.
Thank you. Any objection? Okay. They're received. And just to clear up one small item. On line 236 in the surrebuttal, the question refers to your rebuttal testimony. I just want it to be clear that you haven't filed any rebuttal.
No.
Go ahead and take a minute to look at that. Make sure I'm not misinterpreting.
Which line again?
236.
That is correct. You're correct.
So that's
it's from direct testimony.
Thank you. Pardon me, Mr. Jeter.
Thank
proceed,
you.
Proceed, please.
And I'll make this clear for the record, Mr. Wheelwright, on line 236 of your surrebuttal testimony, should that question read, have you modified your calculation of the CAPM model from your direct testimony?
Yes, that is correct.
Have you prepared a brief statement on the return on equity?
Yes, I have.
And please go ahead.
Thank you. The primary objective of regulation is to produce results for a regulated utility that closely approximates the conditions that would be obtained if the utility and services were determined in a competitive market. A public utility is responsible to provide adequate service to its customers and also establish rates sufficient to provide the utility with the opportunity to cover all reasonable costs, including a fair rate of return on the capital employed. Regulation and a commission-allowed ROE provide the utility with the right to earn a fair rate of return, but does not guarantee a specific return. The fair rate of return or cost of capital is established and applied to the rate base since the company is financed with a combination of both debt and equity. The cost of debt or the interest rate is known and can be calculated, while the cost of equity must be estimated using various models. Previous decisions have established the guiding principles to be used by regulatory commissions and have established three important responsibilities in determining the cost of capital. First, the public utility is entitled to earn a return on the value of its property, which it employs. Second, the return should be reasonably sufficient to assure confidence in the financial soundness of the utility. And third, the return on equity, the return of the utility should be adequate under efficient economical management to maintain and support its credit and enable it to raise the money necessary for continued operations. In reality, there is no single or specific number for the fair rate of return. The concept represents a zone of reasonableness and is based on the assumptions used in the analysis and on the judgment and perspective of the individual. I have performed an analysis to estimate the cost of capital, particularly with respect to the cost of equity. In my direct and surrebuttal testimony, I have included the calculations for the various models and believe that the appropriate cost of equity for Questar Gas is 9.45%. The division's recommendation is near the midpoint of the calculated range and is based on the average of the discounted cash flow model, the capital asset pricing model, and the comparable earnings model. In preparing the analysis, I have included 9 natural gas companies to serve as the proxy group. With the exception of one of the companies, all of the comparable companies are the same as those used in the analysis completed by Questar Gas. In completing the single and two-stage discounted cash flow model, I have used the forecast growth rates as reported by Reuters, Zacks, Yahoo Finance, and Valueline. In my final recommendation, I have selected the higher Valueline growth rate, which calculates the cost of equity in this model at 9.26%. In the capital asset pricing model, I use the 30-year U.S. Treasury as the risk-free rate and the 87-year average risk premium as calculated by Ibbotson. I have included the beta value for each of the comparable companies as reported by Reuters, Zacks, Yahoo Finance, and Valueline. While I have included the size premium in my exhibits, my final recommendation does not include the size premium due to the uncertainty over the use of the industry and size premiums for public utilities. Using the higher beta value reported by Valueline, the capital asset pricing model calculates a cost of equity of 8.48%. The comparable earnings model includes the return on common equity for the comparable companies and calculates the average return for 2012, along with the 3- and 5-year average returns. The 3-year average return for the comparable companies is 10.71%, or just 16 basis points higher than the Questar average of 9.55. As a final comparison, I have included what other commissions across the country have determined to be the allowed rate of return for natural gas companies over the last 3 years. The recommended rate for Questar Gas compares favorably with the 9.66% average for the authorized return for natural gas companies in 2013. Based on my analysis, I believe that the recommended rate is fair and reasonable and will allow the company to earn an adequate return on the value of its property employed, will allow the company to remain financially sound, and raise the money necessary for continued operations. That concludes my summary.
Mr. Wheelwright is available for cross-examination.
Thank you. Who desires to cross-examine? Mr. Monson.
Thank you, Mr. Wheelwright. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just want to ask you a few questions. In the DCF model, we're attempting to determine what a shareholder expects he'll receive in cash flow from buying a stock. Is that right?
Yes.
And so we're looking at the current dividend yield and then the growth, expected growth in the dividend out into perpetuity. If we can estimate that.
Yes.
And the growth projection is the hardest part of that analysis, isn't it?
It is.
Would you agree that in determining whether to buy a stock, an investor, and how much to pay for it, an investor would look at all the information they could about that company, all the information that's readily available?
I don't know if that's a fair representation. I don't know what other investors would do. I don't know.
Do you think that would be a good thing to do if you're an investor?
It's certainly more information is better than less.
And so an investor looking at a stock of a utility might want to look at their historical earnings growth rate and their projections of their earnings as well as analysts' growth forecasts. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think they might look at that, yes. I don't know if they would have access to the analysts or the company's forecast. I don't know if anybody would look at that.
Well, if they were published in their reports to the Securities and Exchange Commission, and if they were given in investor presentations to investors, obviously those investors at least would know what they were. Is that right?
If they're making presentations to investors, yes. If they're making presentations to analysts, they would not have that information.
Thank you. Mr. Curtis testified that he thinks that currently the investment analysts on average are underestimating the growth rate of the utility companies. Do you recall that?
Yes.
And in response to that, you cited a research study by Thomson Reuters. Is that right?
Yes, I did.
And that study, and I've got a copy of it if you want to refer to it, but wasn't that a study of investment analysts' projections of quarterly earnings per share numbers?
It was looking at, I believe the report, if I remember correctly, said that their long-term projections were historically high, where their projection for a year into the future was closer to being accurate.
Maybe we ought to look at it for a minute.
Okay.
Is it okay if I approach the witness?
Yes. And if you have copies for the commission, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Wheelwright, have you had a chance to look at this?
Just briefly.
Is this the document you cited in your testimony?
I believe it is.
Okay. And the title of the document, the subtitle, an analysis of the life cycle of quarterly earnings estimates, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
And isn't it true that this report shows that in the short term, that the analysts tend to underestimate, but as they get farther out in estimating quarterly earnings, that they get closer?
I believe that's the summary, yes.
Okay.
That closer in time they are to the actual earnings, they're more accurate.
I think it's the opposite. Maybe we ought to look at it. Let's see. Look at the second bullet point on the first page. Can you read that?
Where are you?
The second bullet point on the first page under highlights.
Analysts tend to overestimate earnings initially, but subsequently downward revisions bring estimates closer to actual earnings.
Okay. So initially they're overestimating, but as they get farther out, they're closer.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yes.
But these are estimates of quarterly earnings, right?
Yes.
That's what this is talking about. This isn't talking about five-year estimates of long-term growth rates, is it?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
They're forecasting their earnings, and I think the same principle would apply. If they're overestimating a few quarters in advance, they're probably going to overestimate further into the future.
Okay, but this study says they don't farther out. Isn't that correct? I mean, maybe you didn't read the whole study, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but.
It says analysts tend to overestimate earnings initially. They overestimate.
Right.
So the earnings predictions will be lower as they get closer in time to the actual event.
So their earnings, their estimates of quarterly earnings, which is what this is talking about. If they're, I think we can go through it in detail. I don't want to take the time to do that. But it says that for about 2 years out, they overestimate, and then they start getting closer. But they're just talking about, they aren't talking about a five-year earnings growth projection. They're talking about the estimate of actual earnings per share for a company. Do you have any reason to disagree with that?
No.
Okay. In your direct testimony, you criticized Mr. Curtis's use of a size adjustment in his CAPN model.
Yes.
But then in your rebuttal testimony, you also used the size adjustment.
I include it in my exhibits, but I don't use it in my summary.
So you didn't average it in your numbers?
No.
That result? Okay. I assume you have reviewed the Ibbotson, the Morningstar annual work evaluation.
Yes, I have.
Book. They talk about the size adjustment in that book, don't they?
They do.
And let me show you a textbook on principles of utility corporate finance. And I'll give you the whole book if you want. I've got copies of relevant pages to pass out. Is that all right?
Yes.
Mr. Wheelwright, can I direct your attention to page 239 of that textbook?
Yes.
Could you read the first paragraph under section 11.9?
One of the key issues in using CAPM turns out to be the size of the firm. Keep going?
Yeah, keep going.
In general, smaller firms face greater financial risk than do large firms. Of course, this is not a hard or fast rule, as bankruptcies of various investment banks, behemoths like Lehman Brothers in 2008 demonstrated. Keep going?
Keep going.
Nevertheless, it has been observed empirically and is often included in ROE estimates that are based on the CAPM.
Okay, and so this is a textbook on principles of utility corporate finance. Does that appear to be correct?
Yes.
Okay. And when you did the CAPM model and included the size adjustment in the CAPM result, what was your result? Do you remember?
I can look. You're referring to?
In your SIR rebuttal.
My SIR rebuttal? Which one would you like to use?
Well, the one you used where you used the CAPM model using the Ibbotson valuation yearbook.
8.48% is what I used in my number.
Right, but that doesn't include the size adjustment.
No, with the size adjustment, 10.04.
10.04. Thank you. There's also some discussion about in your testimony about the possibility of a bond rating downgrade. Is that right?
Yes.
And you say that even with a 100 basis point adjustment in the ROE, that the analysis shows there would not be a decrease in bond rating. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. But you would agree that a reduction in the ROE would translate into a decrease in the credit metrics that go into determining the bond rating. Is that correct?
I was basing my information on the calculation provided by Mr. Curtis, which showed that in any of the scenarios, either the office's position, the division's position, or the company's position, the ratings would be the same.
Okay, but can you turn, well, why don't you turn to your sir rebuttal page, excuse me, line 112. And there you acknowledge that the different allowed returns do slightly change the key ratio calculations.
That's correct.
So if the commission were to authorize a lower ROE than 10.35, then the bond, the credit metrics would decline.
It would change the metrics. That's correct.
Okay. And you also agree that if you have a lower rate of debt, that you do have a higher cost of debt.
A lower rated bond, a lower rated debt does carry a higher rate of return.
Okay. Thank you. Just one other thing. In your sur rebuttal testimony, you provide a chart showing authorized rates of return through 2013. Is that right?
Yes.
Could you turn to that? It's exhibit 1.2 SR.
Yes.
And you show there on the first page a 2013 average ROE, authorized ROE of 9.66.
Yes.
Would you agree with me that if you look at the authorized ROEs during the last quarter of 2013, that actually the average for those ROEs would be higher than 9.66?
Yeah, the last half of the year, they were higher than they were in the first half.
And that there's four out of those 10 results in the last quarter of 2013 that are actually 10% or over.
That's true. I think we need to also look at what's happened and look back a little further and notice that the 2012 return, the average was 9.94. So the trend is going down.
Well, did the trend turn in the middle of 2013? Isn't it possible?
I'm looking at year over year from 12 to 13, the trend is down.
Okay, but you don't see any 10% in the first half of 2013,
no.
Right? But you see four in the second half. And actually, not in the second half, but in the last quarter. Okay. Thank you. That's all my questions.
Mr. Commissioner, I have just a brief cross question. Good morning, Ms. Wheelwright. Just one quick question on your rebuttal testimony. is exhibit number 1.1 SR of your rebuttal testimony?
Yes.
I'm trying to understand one of the numbers there. It's in the right column, Questar Gas rebuttal testimony. You have a number. It's 9.82%, the average of calculated methods. How did you arrive at that number?
I wanted to make my analysis similar to what the company had proposed. And so there's so many numbers flying around. It's hard to get your arms around this. So I wanted to show the company's proposal compared to mine. The 9.82 is an average of the 8.57 on the DCF, the 10.3 on the CAPM, and I believe the comparable earnings of 10.6 comes up to an average of 9.82. That's how I did my average, and I wanted to see what it would do using the same criteria under the company's calculations.
And you excluded the 10.75 company growth estimate in that average, correct?
I did.
And why did you exclude that 10.75?
That calculation has never been used before by the company. I don't have a lot of confidence in the estimate, the growth estimate that was used in that, and so I excluded it.
All right. No further questions.
Any further?
No, but I should offer, I guess we could offer the one with the orange top, the Thomson Reuters report, as QGC Cross 1, and the excerpt from Principles of Utility Corporate Finance as QGC Cross 2. I would offer those.
Any objection?
I have no objection.
They're received. Questions for Mr. Wheelwright from the commission?
I have some redirect.
Oh, pardon me. Thank you.
It's okay.
Redirect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'm going to just start working backwards a little bit through a couple of the questions that were asked by the company and ask a little more clarification. The first, would you please turn to 1.2 SR, which is the chart of the recent rate case decisions. Can you tell me the return on equity approved in the last two rate case decisions?
9.72 and 9.08.
Okay. And so depending on what period we choose, if we look at a short-term trend, would it be fair to say that the short-term trend is significantly downward?
Yes.
Through the probably the last month or two?
Yes, it would.
Okay. Do you think that that short-term, very short-term trend is indicative, is enough data points to make a assumption about the overall market direction?
No, I don't.
With just two? Okay, thank you. With respect to the textbook that you have in front of you, I believe we're on page 239. And this textbook article or section 11.9 is describing CAPM firm size adjustments. Is there anything that, and I'll give you a second to look through that, is there anything that would suggest that this is a firm size adjustment for regulated utilities? Or would it be more accurate to say that this is just a introduction to CAPM and firm size and that these adjustments are for the market as a whole and not specifically regulated utilities?
I have not. I mean, this has just been presented to me. I don't know. It's hard to say what it is, but I would.
If you want to take a minute to read that, we can just see if you find anything that indicates that these are for regulated utilities. I see Exxon Mobil is mentioned in here.
We'll be off the record for a moment.
Okay.
On the record.
In reviewing this very quickly, what I've been asked to look at is section 11.9 was what I was asked to read. If I look at 11.8, it says, next we turn to the real-world example to estimate the CAPM of regulated utilities in Central America. So it looks like we're not even dealing with U.S. companies.
Okay. Thank you. Now, I'd like you to maybe turn, I'm not sure where you're going to find this in this book. Could you maybe turn to, where's my best, can I have a brief moment to look at that book?
We'll be off the record.
Thank you.
Next time we all want copies of the book, Mr. Monson.
Okay. go back on the record.
On the record.
Mr. Wheelwright, I've opened that to the discounted cash flow chapter of that book. Could you briefly look through that chapter and see if you can find the method used by Mr. Curtis in that chapter?
I don't think I need to look. I don't believe it's there.
Okay. Thank you. Was my last question related to that book. I'd like you to now turn to what's been marked as Questar Gas Company Cross Exhibit 2. And this is the published article titled Estimates Too High, Low, Check the calendar.
Okay.
Is this one or two?
This is two. It should be orange at the top, unless I've marked it wrong. Certainly right? Possible.
I have it as one, but just to make sure we're all on the same page.
This one's one. That was one. I've marked them the opposite. I apologize. Right. So we are looking at Questar Gas Company Cross Exhibit 2.
One.
Okay, let's try this again. We are looking at Questar Gas Company Cross Exhibit 1. If you'll turn to the third page of this, it shows a chart with a couple of downward sloping lines. In explaining this above, in the first paragraph at the top of this page, would you read the last sentence, which starts with at the end?
I'm not sure I know where you...
Just for the record, I don't think there are page numbers on here.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know where you are.
We're looking at Exhibit 2.
Yes.
S&P 500 mean bias and quarterly EPS growth estimates, is that?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And I'll just read it and you can tell me if this is correct.
Which page you're on again?
It's the page with Exhibit 2, which I believe is the third page of the document.
Okay, yeah, I have that.
And it states that at the end of the quarter, beginning of earnings season, growth estimates were most accurate. And this chart below shows a trend from about 20% positive down to a near zero mark. Does that indicate that, would you say that the indication of that is that as the analysts come closer to a particular end of a quarter, they get more accurate? And so the further out they are, the less accurate they are?
Yes, I believe that's correct.
Thank you. I think that's all the questions that I have for redirect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cheddar. Questions from the commission? Thank you, Mr. Wheelwright.
Do have one recross question. I'm sorry.
That's fair enough. That's all right.
All right. I've got another exhibit. May I?
Yes.
Mr. Wheelwright, you were asked whether this book was dealing with setting returns for regulated utilities. Could you look at the second sentence under Section 11.5 and just read that sentence?
In determining appropriate rates of return, is that the one you want?
Yeah, that's the one.
In determining appropriate rates of return for regulated utilities, however, we are concerned with the future. That is, we need a forward-looking estimate of beta.
Thank you. That's all. And I'd offer this as QGC Cross 3.
Any objection? It's received. Anything further?
Like redirect?
Yes.
Actually, I'll skip it. We can.
All right.
Waive redirect.
You're excused, Mr. Wheelwright. Thank you. Mr. Coleman.
The office is prepared to call Mr. Daniel Lawton. Do we need a break for the? We're good. Okay.
We've only been going about 40 minutes. I think we're good.
Check our court reporters.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Lawton. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Please be seated.
Thank you.
Mr. Lawton, could you state your name and business address for the record?
Yes, my name is Daniel Lawton, Lawton, and my business address is 12600 Hill Country Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78738.
What is the nature of your participation in this docket?
I was asked to review the company's cost of capital request in this docket by the office.
The Office of Consumer Services?
Of Consumer Services. I forgot the rest of their name. Thank you.
Just want to make, and under that charge, did you have the opportunity to provide direct testimony dated October 30th, 2013, composed of 41 pages of testimony and exhibits OCS 2.1 through OCS 2.12?
I did.
Did you also have the opportunity to produce surrebuttal testimony dated January 7th, 2014, consisting of 10 pages with attached exhibits OCS SR 2.1 through OCS SR 2.8?
I did.
Do you have any corrections or changes?
None that I'm aware of.
Do you adopt that testimony as your testimony for this proceeding today?
I do adopt it as true and correct.
Do you have a summary of the office's position with respect to this matter today?
I do, and I'll be brief. Commissioners, I filed testimony in this case supporting a 9.3% return on equity relative to the company's request of 10.35%. And in my testimony, both direct and surrebuttal, I believe that the market data, both the market data from pre-October 30th when I filed my direct, and the market data up through the first part of December, supports a 9.3% return on equity for this firm. The market data was applied to four generally accepted models, very similar to models employed by the company and by the department, those models being the discounted cash flow, being the constant cash flow model. I also employed a two-stage discounted cash flow model. I employed a empirical capital asset pricing model and a risk premium model. The application of these generally accepted models, not only in the financial literature, but in regulatory commissions around the country, applying these models to current market data and updated market data supports a 9.3% return on equity. I applied these models and this data to a comparable group of proxy companies. It's the very same comparable group that was employed by company witness Curtis, who was up here earlier this morning. So we don't have any differences in terms of the comparable group. Where the differences are, and you've heard them earlier, and I point them out in my surrebuttal testimony, the differences are in the growth rate calculation, what you employ, And in the capital asset pricing model that I'll talk about in a minute concerning the size premium. Most analysts, most regulatory authorities, most financial theory and textbooks, when evaluating the discounted cash flow model, will generally look to the forecasted estimates of earnings, dividends, or book value per share. Historical information provides little help in estimating what investors expect in the future unless you truly believe what's happened over the past 5 or 10 years is going to be replicated into the future into perpetuity, as been discussed earlier. There is no basis, I believe, and I've pointed out in my testimony, for employing historical growth rates. So that the major difference between the parties, and I pointed out in my testimony, is do we give any weight to the historical growth rates? The other difference in the capital asset pricing model, and it was just being discussed a few moments ago with the last witness, Mr. Wheelwright, is the size premium. Should we employ an adder for company size? And as I point out in my testimony and in the cited financial literature as well, there is a historical difference between large firms and small firms. Small firms generally have a higher return on equity. But that's not necessarily true for regulated firms. And you can see the differences between a regulated and a non-regulated firm. If I lose my largest customer as Questar, my earnings don't suffer so long as I come in for a rate increase and I have what's called a billing determinants case with this commission. My prices and rates are increased and there's no harm. For a non-regulated firm, clearly they've got no place to go but the market. So the application of the size premium, you need to recognize the difference between a regulated and a non-regulated firm, and I cited an article from the financial literature that addresses that point. There is a difference. The other point I make in my testimony is that the market data and the modeling performed by Mr. Curtis does not support his 10.35% recommendation. No matter how you look at his numbers, how you add them or average them, 10.35 is not supported. And it's only because the company got 10.35 3 years ago that they won it again. And that's not an estimate of investor expectations. That's a number that this commission authorized in those facts and circumstances over 3 years ago. Now, there's been a great deal of discussion in all the testimonies and in the hearing this morning with regard to authorized rates of return around the country. You commissioners are going to evaluate all this evidence that the witnesses have written. The authorized rates of return are trending down. There's no question about it. Around the country, it has been trending down for some time. That's just one point or a point of guidance for any regulatory authority that they employ in evaluating the evidence. What's happening around the country? But clearly, I think the evidence in this case supports a return much lower than the 10.35% requested by the company, whether or not the equity returns around the country are declining. Lastly, I address financial integrity and financial metrics. The evidence in this case presented by the company, Questar's rebuttal testimony, applies the return on equity I recommend of 9.3%, as well as the DPU return on equity, and it applies them to the financial metrics that will result. You can see from the company's own financial testimony and from mine that I present in my direct testimony that a 9.3% return on equity will not cause the bond rating to fall. Actually, the company's own testimony shows it to be the same result as authorizing a 10.35. So if you're looking at financial metrics and bond rating, there's no reason to raise consumers' rates unnecessarily and award the 10.35. For all those reasons, I believe a 9.3% return on equity is appropriate in this case, again, supported by the market data and supported by the evidence that's presented to you today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
At this time, the office would move for admission into the record of Mr. Lawton's direct testimony identified as OCS, exhibit number OCSS-2D Lawton, as well as exhibits OCS 2.1 through 2.12, and Mr. Lawton's surrebuttal testimony, exhibit OCS-2SR Lawton, and attach exhibits OCS-SR 2.1 through OCS-SR 2.8.
Any objection? They're received.
And Mr. Lawton is available for cross-examination.
Okay. Mr. Jetter or Lieutenant Colonel Feig?
I have no cross-examination.
Okay. Mr. Monson?
I have some. Mr. Lawton, good morning.
Good morning. Is it Mr. Monson?
Yes.
Okay, sir. Yeah. Thank you.
And I was trying to remember if we've ever been in this position before. I guess we haven't.
I just met you today, right now.
Okay, because you've testified in a lot of Rocky Mount Power Rate cases on cost capital, right?
I have indeed, but I don't remember you from any of those cases.
I think none of them went to hearing, probably. That's been what happened. Anyway, some of them did go to hearing, so I don't know. Anyway, a question came up earlier about whether you would include Questar Gas's projection of its own expected growth rate in a calculation. If you were a witness in a general rate case involving Northwest Natural Gas, wouldn't you include Northwest Natural Gas in your list of proxy companies?
It would depend on the population of proxies I had available, and if it was another data point and it was reasonable, then I may in fact use it. It would depend on the facts and circumstances. Generally, the company you're evaluating, you typically don't include in your proxy group, but separate it out and perform the analyses on the separate company. And lastly, there is no forecast of Questar's earnings per share. That was the predicate to your question, and there's none in evidence, and there's none filed at the SEC that I found.
I don't think I said earnings per share, but anyway, leaving that aside. So, okay, but I mean, if you're trying to evaluate the cost of capital for a utility, and it is traded on
yes,
the
sir.
Market, you obviously would consider that utility's own results, dividend, estimate of growth rate and stuff in your analysis. Even maybe to say it's in the proxy group is overstating it, but you'd certainly consider it, wouldn't you?
Yes, I always or generally calculate when a utility is publicly traded, I will show it as an additional line item above and beyond the proxy group.
Okay.
Where there's market data to do that.
Right. You acknowledge in your testimony, and this is in your direct testimony if you want to look at it, on lines 191 and 192.
Okay. Give me a moment.
Okay.
I'm there.
Okay. It's a generally accepted premise that a utility's cost of equity capital is the risk-free return plus the premium required by investors for accepting the risk of investing in equities. That's what you say, right?
Yeah, that's straight out of financial theory.
Right. And now let's turn for a minute to your exhibit, surrebuttal exhibit 2.1.
I'm there.
Okay. Now, if I look at the first column, column A, that's the yield or the interest rate on 30-year Treasury bonds, right?
It's the current yield on a reported yield on U.S. Treasury bonds, 30
right.
years.
And if I look at that, in 2009, it was 3.13, and then it started going up, and it went up until about mid 2010. Is that right?
That is correct. You can see a break off April 1st, 2010, following that.
Right, and then it started declining again for a few months, and then it kind of hovered around that area until early 2011. Is that right?
It went up and down. I'm sorry, I don't mean to talk over you.
Yeah, I'm sorry too. So anyway, it went down, then it went back up again, right?
It did. That's what the numbers say.
Okay. And then starting in, well, the low point on this, as you've shown in the exhibit, is actually in July of 2012, right?
It is for columns A, B, C, and D, but not for column E.
Okay. And focusing on column A, so it was 2.59% in July of 2012, and then it's 3.80% in November of 2013, right?
That is correct.
And that's an increase of, let's see, that's an increase of 121 basis points, right?
It is.
And that'd be about a 45% increase in the interest rate. Right.
If calculating it that way, the percent increase in the overall yield, then yes, it is approximately 45%. But okay. Of course, these interest rates weren't employed for setting your return, Questar's, your clients.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you just said.
I said, well, you started at, pointed out the low point of 2.59 occurred in July of 2012.
Right.
That has nothing to do with setting the return on equity for Questar Gas. That last return on equity was set, an order came out sometime in 2010.
Oh, you're
referring. So when you're referring to the percent increase and all that on interest rates, you have to make sure you're measuring apples to apples.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that the when the rates were set in the prior rate case, that was actually before this low point.
It was.
Right. But in the last, what is it, how many months? In the last about 13 months,
yes.
The interest rate on 30-year Treasury bonds has increased substantially, hasn't it?
It has from the levels it was at.
Okay.
And again, that doesn't translate to a concomitant increase in the return on equity. Interest rates don't go up in linearly with the return on equity or equity costs.
Do you know how long it takes to do a rate case in Utah?
I've been involved in a few over the years, and I'm trying to recall. I'm in Utah today. I think it's 6 to 9 months, somewhere around there.
8 months, I think.
I was close.
Would you accept that?
I would accept it. Most jurisdictions are a year or under, and I recalled Utah was a bit shorter, which means you have less regulatory lag, which helps enhances your financials.
So if rate cases take 8 months or a year or in that time frame roughly, then wouldn't you expect that there'd be a lag between changes in interest rates and authorized ROEs?
It depends. For example, in this case now, as we sit here today, we're talking about relatively current interest rates, yet you filed your case back in July. So this commission, when it's making its order, is considering the interest rates that it sees now.
Okay.
So there's not as much of a lag as you would presume.
Okay, let's turn for a minute to the growth rate in the DCF model.
Okay. Do you have a site you want me to look at?
You've got a table in your direct testimony, I guess, where you list a whole bunch of information about growth rates. I think it's...
five?
Exhibit. I think it's exhibit... let's see. Yeah, it's exhibit 2.6, OCS 2.6.
Yes, there's two pages. First page?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm looking at right now, the first page. If I'm reading this correctly, you've got 5-year, 10-year, 5-year, 5-year. These are all historic, right? And you got a historical average.
Yes, those are the historical growth rates as reported by Valueline.
So why did you put in your testimony information about historical growth rates?
Because that's something that you always want to look at and consider. Is it going to are those historical growth rates representative of the future? And in this case, and in examining those growth rates, does not appear to me that there's no evidence that investors are looking at historical growth rates. But you'll find every testimony that I put together and evaluate for any commission, I put out both the historical and the forecasted data.
So you think it's important to at least consider them?
Sure, you can't ignore it. Investors certainly look at it, but then you have to take the next step and ask yourself, what evidence is there to suggest that this history, these historical growth rates, will repeat themselves in the future, and investors think that that's important?
On lines 619 and 620 of your direct testimony.
Yes, sir. Give me a moment.
Yeah, I'll give you a moment.
I am there.
Okay. You say, Mr. Curtis abandoned his forecasted growth estimates in favor of historical growth for estimating his DCF capital costs. You see that?
Yes, sir.
Isn't it true that Mr. Curtis reported the results of his forecast, analyst forecast projected growth rates? Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. I should have said it. Mr. Curtis abandoned all his analyses and just relied on the 10.35 they got last time.
Okay. And isn't it also true that his 10.35 is actually between the result he got using the analyst growth forecasts and the historical growth rates plus company projections of growth in earnings?
It's in the range, but the basis for selecting it is that's what we got last time.
I just was trying to understand why you said he abandoned it.
Well, he abandoned them in that his testimony points out that he believes that analyst forecasts are systematically biased. You heard your witness, Mr. Curtis, say this morning that you would want to use reasonable and rational data. And if something is systematically biased, you would abandon it.
So you assume...
That was my presumption from reading his testimony.
All right. Thank you. You also make the point in your testimony that all of your DCF results, you excluded results less than 7.5%. Is that right?
Yeah, 7.5 or 8%. I used one of those cutoff numbers because it was unreasonable.
Yeah, and if you look at lines 633 to 636 of your direct...
I used 7.5% here.
Okay. And you say you did that because no regulatory authorities are considering or authorizing equity returns below 7.5%, and investment alternative returns would likely keep investors from seeking returns below 7.5%. Is that right?
That's what I said.
Okay. If we look at your exhibits, 2.7 and 2.8, can you look at those for a minute?
Sure.
Have you got them?
I'm at 2.7.
Okay. Okay, now look at the comparable group forecasted growth.
I got a letter at the top. Which column?
Column G.
Yes, sir.
Is there any results there that are under 7.5?
No.
Okay, now look at 2.8. And in fact, the difference between column K and column L, if I read the footnotes correctly, is that column L excludes results below 7.5. Is that right?
No. It's based on using a different growth rate. Column E is, are you on 2.7?
2.8.
Oh, 2.8. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
On 2.8, the difference between column K and column L, in this case, they were the same because nothing was below 7.5%.
Right. So although you say in your testimony that you excluded results below 7.5%, there actually were no results
right.
below
7.5%. Right. But that's something that I do, and the model is built, as you see, both columns K and L, in instances when there's a result below 7.5%, these two columns would be different.
Okay. And isn't it true that no regulatory authority has approved a rate below 8.8% in the last 3 years?
I don't know that that's true. I haven't investigated them all, but there are regulatory decisions out there that sometimes a utility gets itself in trouble and does have a problem with its regulator.
Did you look at Mr. Wheelwright's exhibit that showed the authorized rates of return for the past 3 years?
I did, but I don't know that that is every rate of return. Those are the returns reported by SNL, and they may not have every authorized return from around the country in every jurisdiction in every case.
Okay. So, but at least on that exhibit, there's no returns below 8.8, is there?
As I recall, I can check it quick, but I can accept that subject to check.
Thank you. If you excluded returns below 8.8% from your analyses, your DCF analyses, you actually would have excluded some results, wouldn't you?
Sure. You know, if I use 9%, I would have excluded even more.
Okay. Okay, now you updated your analysis in your surrebuttal testimony, right?
I did.
And it showed an increase of 6 basis points in your DCF result, right?
I think so. It should be on table 1 on page 2. Yeah.
Okay, and
I think you said 6 basis points. If you look midpoint to midpoint, it's actually 10.
Okay. And how much did it increase on your CAPM, your two-stage DCF? Sorry. Maybe that's what you're talking about.
Well, the midpoint went from 9.2 to 9.3, so that's 10.
10, okay. And how about your ECAPM result?
It went from 9.1 to 9.2.
I must have been looking at something different. Where are you looking?
I'm looking on table 2 of my surrebuttal testimony. Okay. Unless I have...
Table 2?
Table 1, I'm sorry. Page 2. Table 1, page 2.
Oh, and you're comparing the midpoints. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I guess I was looking at your exhibit and comparing the averages. In any event, they all went up, right?
No. Risk premium didn't go up. The basic midpoint to midpoint is still 9.9.
Okay. All right. But you didn't increase your recommended ROE based on the increase in the updates that you made.
No, as a matter of fact, I recommended 9.3, and I point out in my testimony that the DCF and the two-stage DCF still support a 9.3, because that's where they come out.
Okay, you also, in your testimony, you said that Questar Gas has a lower risk as a result of mechanisms such as the forecast test year, the conservation enabling tariff, and the infrastructure replacement tracker. Is that right?
I think I said both... lower risk, and I think I might have used the phrase regulatory enhancement, and is treated well by the Utah Public Utility Commission.
Okay. You haven't provided any evidence of whether the other companies that you've considered in your comparable company group have these same mechanisms, have you?
No. I think I stated as such that many of the companies have the same mechanisms. Did I put a table together showing you the mechanisms? No.
You've reviewed, I assume, Mr. Curtis's rebuttal testimony?
I did.
Did you review the table on page 9 of his rebuttal testimony?
I believe I did. What's the site?
Page 9.
I don't have his rebuttal. Do you have an extra copy, sir?
Well, I'll be happy to share mine with you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Yes, I've seen this testimony.
Okay. And you don't have any basis to disagree with his presentation there, do you?
No, other than his characterization. If you're assuming that these rate stabilization and infrastructure replacement programs are the same as what Questar has and is requesting in this case, then I would differ with you. That they have something they call a infrastructure replacement, that's true.
Okay, thank you. Okay, you talk about the fact that your recommended ROE would not impact the financial integrity of the company. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, can we turn to, now, you don't have this either, I guess, so maybe I need to give it to you. And you refer to Mr. Curtis's exhibit.
Right. I think it's his last schedule in his testimony.
Right.
And he runs the financial metrics for his recommendation as well as the department's and mine. I'll need it. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Manson. Yes, this is the schedule I was referring to.
Okay. And can you just look with me at some of these credit metrics and what the ratings indications are? For example, on line...
Mr. Monson, could we identify it by exhibit number?
Yeah.
Or?
Sure. It's exhibit Questar QGC exhibit 2.3R. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. And let's just look at, for example, line 26. And this is based in column B on Questar's proposed 10.35, right?
Column B, yes.
Okay, and what's the indicated credit rating?
BAA.
Okay. And then if you go down to line 30, based on Questar's recommended ROE, what's the indicated credit rating?
What line were you on?
30.
30? That would, again, be BAA.
And if you go down to line 36, what is the indicated rating given Questar's requested ROE?
BAA.
And if you go down to line 40, what is the indicated credit rating?
Triple B.
Okay, and are each of those indicated credit ratings lower than Questar's current credit rating?
Yes, but again, this is only 40% of the overall makeup of the evaluation of the bond credit rating. There's much more that goes into it than just this.
Okay, and isn't one of the things that rating agencies consider the authorized ROE?
No. For example, I cited in my testimony that Moody's, which is a rating agency, says that a high ROE should not be, authorized ROE should not be focused on. What should be focused on is regulatory earnings mechanisms, such as the infrastructure program and those kinds of mechanisms. That comes right out of Moody's evaluations.
So you don't think that when a rating agency is looking at the credit rating of a utility, it looks at, you don't think it looks at the authorized ROE to determine if there's a healthy and favorable regulatory climate in that state?
It may look at it, but it looks at the earned rate of return. There's a very big difference between the authorized rate of return and what's actually earned. Many utility commissions can come up with a high authorized rate of return, and that utility, given the rate structure, may not have a chance of earning it. So the ratings agencies will want to look at the ability to earn it, and how do you earn it? Through the rate-making mechanisms, and that's what Moody's and S&P focus on, and I cited it in my testimony.
Okay, and if a company has a higher authorized ROE, would you agree with me that they have a higher opportunity of having a higher earned ROE as well?
No.
Since their rates will be higher?
No, you cannot say that in a vacuum. Because you have a high authorized rate of return does not necessarily translate that you have the ability to earn that authorized rate of return. You have to look at a lot more than just what was authorized.
In determining the earned rate of return, isn't it important to know what the revenues of the company are?
It is.
And aren't the revenues higher if the commission sets the rates based on a higher authorized rate of return than a lower authorized rate of return?
Revenues are higher, but also expenses and the ability to recover certain expenses. You have to look at the complete order. And just looking at the authorized rate of return gets you nowhere. You would not want to invest your money that way.
That's all my questions. Thank you, Mr. Long.
Thank you, Mr. Manson.
Thank you. Redirect.
I have nothing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lawton.
Hey, thank you, Commissioners. You have a good day. It's good being back in Utah.
Is there anything further? And Lieutenant Colonel Fike, you raised the question yesterday of summation, I think. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Commissioner. I just wanted to know if we would have had the opportunity to summarize again. The federal agencies are not putting testimony in this case, similar to other interveners. And I know I didn't want to break ranks and advocate for a 10-page final brief, but if we had the opportunity to provide a closing summary of our position, I would welcome that opportunity.
If we is there any objection to using sort of the same process we did yesterday, and take a brief break and then allow each council to point out the facts and opinions that have been offered that they consider to be most important, most salient? Is there, how do you?
If I could address that, I think Questar's position is that our witness's summary has really done an excellent job of summarizing the company's position, but we would not oppose letting Lieutenant Colonel Feig put on a summary, especially since he did not have a witness, if that's what he intends to do. But I, from the company's perspective, we believe our witness's summary suffices.
Mr. Jetter and Mr. Coleman, do you have a position to express on this question?
I think the division would be fine either way. We're happy to provide whatever the commission thinks would be helpful. We're happy to let Mr. Feig provide a statement if you would like, or we can all do on whatever the commission would prefer.
I would say similar to the company's position. I have certainly no concerns letting the federal agencies present a summary. My summary would probably sound much like my witness's summary.
Lieutenant Colonel Fike, are you prepared to do that now? Or?
Yes, I am. I can do that now before a break if you'd like.
I think we'll go forward if you're
right.
Ready.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Commissioners, when intervening in various utility rate cases across the United States, my colleagues and I are often asked, why is the Air Force, at a utility rate case? And it's really because the tax dollars that are appropriated by Congress and used to pay utility bills at a federal or military installation, particularly, come from the installation's operations and maintenance budget. This O&M budget, as often is called O&M budget, not only pays for utility bills, it is also the same pot of money that is used to fund the day-to-day operations of a military installation. Therefore, at the end of the day, every additional tax dollar that is spent by the DOD on utilities is a dollar that is not available to spend on flying the jets, taking care of the troops, and protecting our nation. It may come as no surprise that the majority of the federal executive agency's interest in this case is due to Hill Air Force Base. And even though all of Hill Air Force Base accounts represent only a subset of Questar's total customer list, and the impact that Hill Air Force Base has on protecting our nation and the local Salt Lake City and Ogden communities in terms of employment, job creation, cannot be understated. So that is why the Air Force is here at this proceeding. The goal is to make sure that the utility is providing reliable service at fair and reasonable rates to ensure that Hill Air Force Base is able to continue its mission. To that end, the FAA requests the Commission give strong weight to the expert witness testimony of the office and the division in arriving at their ROE determination. The FAA believes that the ROE recommendation of 9.3% by the office's expert, Mr. Lawton, and 9.45% by the division's expert, Mr. Wheelwright, are more credible than the 10.35% recommendation by the company's witness, Mr. Curtis. The flaws in Mr. Curtis's testimony, especially in his company growth estimate used in his discounted cash flow analysis,
have been well documented through cross-examination this morning. Additionally, Mr. Curtis has stated that he believes the commission should approve a 10.35% ROE because that was the same rate that was approved by the commission in the last rate case. However, by Mr. Curtis's own admission this morning, the financial conditions during the last rate case were drastically different than they are now. During the last rate case, the U.S. was still in the midst of a significant recession, the greatest one since the Great Depression. National unemployment was above 10%, and credit markets were very tight. Since 2009, financial conditions have improved. Additionally, Questar's cost of long-term debt has been reduced from 6.25% in 2009 to 5.16% at the end of 2014. It will be at the end of 2014, a reduction of 17%. This reduction in cost of long-term debt alone justifies a reduction in the company's ROE from its 2009 levels. However, when considering the current improved financial market conditions and the more realistic discounted cash flow models presented by experts Lawton and Wheelwright, the FEA maintains that there is an overwhelming evidence for the commission to support an ROE closer to the 9.3% and 9.45% recommended by witnesses Lawton and Wheelwright. In summary, every dollar of increased utility cost passed on by Questar to their customers is $1 less that Hill Air Force Base can spend flying operations and training, as well as, at least for Hill Air Force Base, the critical logistics center maintenance facilities. When costs go up, something has to give. The FEA respectfully requests the commission to approve an ROE closer to the 9.3 or 9.45% levels recommended by the division and the office. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further before we adjourn the hearing? We're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Mr. Commissioner, just to be clear, we still have the public hearing section of the proceedings this evening at 5 o'clock, correct?
Thank you for, we do have it at 5 o'clock tonight, a public witness hearing. It's important that we all remain mindful of that. We'll be here, and you're all welcome to be here as well.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Mr. Commissioner, could I be excused from that portion of the hearing?
Yes.
All right, thank
yes.
You.
You're all free to exercise your discretion, except for the applicant. We expect the applicant to be here.
And state law requires me to be here.